Hi, Cliff Goldstein here. Glad you tuned into the show. Many centuries ago, well, I guess about 23 or 24 to be more precise, Plato wrote a dialogue called The Sophist. And in it, he talked about a war between two groups, the earth giants and the gods. Earth giants and the gods. On the side of the gods, which was Plato's side, by the way, was the idea that knowledge is different from belief and opinion. It's the idea that there is a qualitative difference between the two, and that while beliefs and opinions could turn out to be wrong, knowledge could be wrong. To truly know something for Plato means that you know the thing is true, it's real, it's right. But the idea, I think, goes a little further. It's the idea that there are things that can be known as true, as necessary and certain. See, it's not the kind of thing that, well, that might be right for you in your situation and your belief system, but not for me in my context and my belief system. That's your truth. You know, that kind of thing. We hear it all the time. Instead, for Plato, it's the idea that there are absolutes, universal, necessary, and certain truths about the world, about reality, truths that can be known by human beings. For instance, Plato was big into math, and, you know, for him, something like 2 plus 2 equals 4 is true whether you live in Athens or Sparta or Carthage. There are certain things that we can know deductively, regardless of who we are or where we live. Basically, Plato is taking a position that certain absolute and necessary truths exist. Things that are certain, absolute, necessarily, regardless of what we might or might not think about them. Now, that's Plato's position, the position of what he calls the gods. Now, in contrast to Plato, there are his opponents, what he called the earth giants. They're the ones that we would call today the relativists. Those who don't believe in these absolutes, that they exist at all. These were what back then were known as the sophists, from whom we get the term sophistry today. Though I don't think it had the same kind of negative connotation back then as it does today. Sophists were derived from the Greek word sophia, for wise or for wisdom. But see, the sophists, they were interested in a different kind of wisdom. For them, unlike Plato, knowledge is not this absolute, universal, and necessary thing that Plato argued for. For them, knowledge and belief and opinion are all kind of the same thing, kind of all on a continuum. Knowledge is always particular, relative, and contingent in training. It's very much like, well, that's your truth, but not for me. It's very much that kind of thing. See, for them, whatever you believe, you have to base it on certain assumptions. And how do you know that your assumptions are correct? You might even change your assumptions. And if you do, then perhaps your knowledge, your beliefs, your system of truth, that will change as well. For the earth giants, knowledge and beliefs are always particular to a certain place, contingent, they change, and probable in that you might be wrong. Well, anyway, as I said, this was a battle that Plato was fighting 23 or 2400 years ago. And this theme, if you read Plato's dialogues, you find this theme reoccurring over and over again in a number of places. Now, what's fascinating, though, is that the same basic issues are still with us today, though in myriad forms. It's the age-old battle between the absolutists, who think that absolute truth exists, and those who think that there's no such thing as absolutes, that things like reality, truth, and morals and so forth are relativistic, contingent, and cultural. Now, even more interestingly, is that this battle exists in the one place that I don't think most folks would expect to find it. And that's in science. In science, the same basic questions remain today, unanswered today, or at least still disputed today, as they were in the streets of Athens 300-400 years before Christ. And they're being asked and debated and fought out in the realm of science, not just in things like ethics or metaphysics or morals and so on and so forth, but in the realm of science. But I mean, you think science? I mean, isn't that all about truth? Isn't that all about reality? Isn't that all about what's really out there? It's about what's proven, what's factual, what's certain, and so forth. I mean, we're talking science now. And what does science care about philosophy or philosophical assumptions or metaphysics or culture or presuppositions or value judgment and worldviews and so forth? We're not talking about bias or cultural prejudice. We're talking science, cold, hard, brute facts about the world and the way the world really is. I mean, that's science, right? Isn't that science? Well, folks, turns out it's not quite so simple. And the fact is that the issues that Plato wrote about, the battle between the gods and the earth giants, continues today, even in the realm of science, and in a very big way. Now, in one sense, it's not that hard to understand. Because if you think about it, science is really almost purely an experiential discipline, is it not? It's based on experience. It's based on our senses. And please, even as I've talked on this show already, who hasn't learned even long ago how deceiving experience can be? I mean, as I said, science is empirical. It's based on what we observed, on what we can be, on what we see in the world. And who doesn't know that experience is always so contingent? Experience is uncertain. It's probable. It's changing. It's changing. You know, I mean, we build devices in order to help us get a different view, a different experience of the world around us. Well, change the device. Change the device and we'll get a changed understanding of the world, won't we? Because our experience of the world comes through the device. And if we change the device, we'll have a different view of what's out there. We'll have a different concept of science and what scientific truths are. The microscope, the telescope, okay, great scientific devices they are. But what do? They change our experience of the world. They change how we see the world. But at the same time, we're still dealing with the same thing. Our experience, don't forget that word because that's crucial, our experience. Science is an experience of how the world appears to our senses. And that's very subjective, to say the least. At the same time, too, though, you ask yourself the question, what good is science if it's not going to give us universal truth? I mean, what good is a theory of gravity which tells us, well, this is how gravity works in our part of the universe, or at this time in Earth's history. But in 100 years, gravity's going to work differently. You know, see, the idea is that if these laws work like this today, then they should be the same tomorrow and on and on and on. I mean, what, you know, the laws of thermodynamics, if the laws of thermodynamics, which we, you know, we used to build jets, if they were to change every week, I doubt we'd ever get too far off the ground. I mean, who wants to fly in a jet based on the principles of gravity that don't apply the way the gravity works this week or the day you're in the air? But see, the whole point of science, the presuppositions of science, is that there is a real world out there and that we can know some things about that world, things that are certain, true, and unchanging. The question is, though, can we? How well can we know them? Do we really even know them? Plato's gods would say we can know them as absolute yet necessary and certain. Now, you would think so if it's really science. Again, I think the scientific principles upon which we build the space shuttle are pretty sound, are they not? I mean, it's gotten the vehicle off the ground and into space and back most times. That science has tapped into something out there. That's for sure. Yes, I think we can know things about the world as absolutes. We can know things about them. Or do we know them the way we know that our political system is better than the folks who live across the river? Do we know them the way we know that certain things are moral and right and wrong and that our moral system is better than somebody else's moral system? But again, you could argue that science is about the real world. It's about what's really out there. And that's fine. I think most people would agree that there is a reality out there, and science attempts to interpret and explain that reality. But you see, that sort of begs the question. For the question remains is, how does science interpret the world? After all, even scientists can know the world, as we said, only through experience, only through the experiments that they create and the experience that they take away from the experiments. I think, in short, however much we'd like to think so, or maybe even some scientists would like to think so, science doesn't somehow step beyond the subjective, the contingencies and the exigencies of experience, and view the world from some kind of uber-neutral, pure objective perspective. On the contrary, science is immersed in experience. In many ways, that's all it can or ever be, is experience. Now, all this leads to is what I want to talk about today. It's very interesting. In the 1900s, the 1990s, this battle, which I said had been going on since Plato, between the earth gods, the earth giants, and the god, was being hashed out by two groups. What they call the postmoderns, the social constructionists, the ones who believe that science, really all knowledge in general, is contingent, culturally conditioned, and the very subject field of study that cannot, and it can't lay claims to truth any more than any kind of study can. In other words, they're saying science doesn't have any more claims to truth than anything else. These are, again, to use Plato's terminology, the earth giants, the relativists. Science, like everything else, is relative and contingent. Against them were many scientists themselves. Not all of them, because even among scientists there's this debate here. But these are the realists. Those who argue that there is an absolute reality out there, and science is about the most rational, logical, and best and most effective way to get to that reality. Again, you could say it was a battle between the modernists, the empiricists, the scientists, against the postmodernists, the followers of folks like Michel Foucault, Jacques Derrida, Paul Feyerabend, those who say that all kinds of knowledge, including science, is relative, conditioned, contingent, and uncertain. And they claim that science itself, especially one kind of science, is not necessarily better than another kind. In fact, sometimes they'll even say science could be kind of racist, sexist, and chauvinistic. And if to think your science is better than someone else's is to be that way. I never forget, too, one woman once wrote that Newton's Principia. That was where he first explained his principles of gravity. Said it was a rate manual. And someone else once said that E=mc² is a sexist equation because it favors the speed of light over other speeds. Okay, it's that kind of stuff. Now, that's a bit extreme, I agree, but there's still this idea that limits what science, that makes science very culturally contingent. So you got those hardcore realists, science tells us what's really out there, and you got the social constructionists, the relativists, the earth giants. Now, this is sort of the battle. Well, in the midst of this battle, a physicist of some renown, Alan Sokal from New York University, submitted a paper to a journal called Social Text. And it was kind of the flagship journal of the social construction of reality folks, these postmoderns, those who see science, as they do all knowledge, as relativistic, contingent, and so forth. Okay? Now, the article was titled Transgressing the Boundaries Towards a Transformative Hermeneutic of Quantum Gravity. Towards a transformative hermeneutic of quantum gravity. Now, I'm going to read you a few excerpts from it. Just bear with me. Just bear with me as I read you some of these excerpts that he wrote. As Althusser rightly commented, Lucan finally gives Freud's thinking the scientific concept that it requires. More recently, Lacan's topology du sujet has been applied fruitfully to cinema criticism and to the psychoanalysis of AIDS, the psychoanalysis of AIDS. In mathematical terms, Lacan is here pointing out that the first homology group of the sphere is trivial, while those of the other surfaces are profound, and this homology is linked with the correctiveness or disconnectedness of the surface after one or more cuts. And he wrote this: furthermore, as Lacan suspected, there is an intimate connection between the external structure of the physical world and its inner psychological representation qua knot theory. The hypothesis has been confirmed by Witten's derivation of knot invariance, in particular the Jones polynomial, from the three-dimensional Chern-Simons quantum field theory. And a little more. Analogous topological structures arise in quantum gravity, but as much as the manifold involved are multidimensional rather than two-dimensional, higher homology plays a group role as well. And then he goes on and on. Now, that sounds rather deep, doesn't it? And heavy, doesn't it? And you know what it is? It's all complete, total, patented, and total unadulterated nonsense. It's nonsense. Sokal spent a great deal of time studying the language and jargon of postmodernism, and then he dumped it here into this hodgepodge of pure nonsense. The whole paper, almost every line, was completely make-believe. You know, I mean, talk about nonsense. What does he say in the paper? Basically, he's saying, in the end, he's saying, hey, you guys are right. Quantum gravity is really a purely social construction as opposed to what's really out there. And see, Sokal took a gamble, too. He bet his papers, he bet that the editors of magazine would not have his paper vetted in a peer review. Okay? He thought that the editors, some of the leading postmodern thinkers of the whole movement, would be so happy to have an eminent physicist from the other side, from the realist side, write a paper, you know, that pretty much takes the position of their publication, that they wouldn't even bother to get it checked for the science. Because if they would have gone, hey, we got this paper from a physicist, you know, tell us what it is. I mean, anybody who knew anything about it would have told them right off the bat that this paper is silliness. It's nonsensical blather. That was Sokal's bet. And he was right. The premier intellectual journal of postmodernism published something a guy made up. Pure silliness. Okay? Then, to make matters worse, Sokal, I guess he was really going to stick the knife in. Right about the time that his article, this transgressing, this hermeneutics of quantum gravity, arguing quantum gravity is a human construct, to make matters worse, Sokal even arranged to have an expose of this hoax published in another paper called Lingua Franca, in which he said that this was an experiment to see if they would even bother to get it peer-reviewed. And they didn't. They didn't. Well, you could imagine. As you can imagine, when this came out, it caused a furor. It caused a furor, at least among the postmodernists and the social construction theorists of knowledge and science. Now, the realists loved it. They thought it was great. They declared, see, we told you, these postmoderns, these social construction folks, they're phonies. They have no idea what they're talking about. I don't know if you've ever done read some of this postmodern stuff, too. Some of the stuff, it is awfully dense, and I don't know, maybe they really are saying something, but when I read it, a lot of the stuff, I can see why people would be duped by that, because it sounds like the typical postmodern stuff. Now, I like what Sokal did. I like what he did because it does throw some water on this whole notion of the relativity of knowledge. I mean, come on. Sure. The world does come to us filtered through our senses. I mean, I have talked about that right in front of these cameras. And sure, the world doesn't come to us objectively. I mean, we know that. There are always contingencies in our knowledge, and that's fine. You know, we all remember the image of the five blind men who are put before an elephant, and each one is asked by using the hand to feel, you know, what's in front of them. They're blind, so they're feeling around. You know the story. One said a tree, one said a hose, one said something else. And the point of that whole little parable, I guess whatever it is to show that there are different perspectives on things. Fine, I agree. I don't know how anybody could disagree with that. But that's fine. However, as long as you don't forget one crucial point, and that is the elephant is still there. Something exists out there. Something that was real, regardless of how difficult it was for folks to know just what. And this is, I think, a crucial point not to lose sight of. That reality comes filtered to us. And again, I've talked about this here. It's an important point. That reality comes filtered to us doesn't mean that there's no objective reality out there. That the five men had different views of the elephant doesn't mean that there wasn't an elephant in the room or that it was not real. It doesn't mean that there wasn't something there. See, it's one thing to say that we see reality contingently, that we see it filtered. I can agree on that. But it's quite another to say that there's nothing real or objective out there to be filtered by us. That's a whole different ball of wax. Absolute truth, absolute reality, it exists. It's there regardless of how much or how little of it we can grasp or see or know. Imagine you're in a house. The windows are closed and everything is closed. You know, windows and you can't see outside. All you got is a peephole. And outside that peephole is a mountain. You might get only a distorted view of a teeny part of the mountain. But in reality, the mountain is there. To deny the mountain as even exists is a whole other ball of wax altogether. That's a whole other story altogether. You know, I think, too, that some folks might have a better view or understanding of truth and reality than others. I mean, who has a better grasp of aerodynamics? A voodoo faith healer or somebody who builds jets that fly? I mean, who comes closer to the truth? Someone who denies the Holocaust or someone who believes in it? Who is closer to truth? Someone who thinks that the moon is made of green cheese? Or someone who thinks it's made from various kind of rocks? Who is closer to truth? Someone who thinks Charles de Gaulle was the first president of the United States or that George Washington was? Who is closer to truth? Someone who thinks that the sun orbits the earth or that the earth orbits the sun? There's a whole host of these things. Truth is out there. Truth exists. Absolute truth exists. Because there's a reality out there. An absolute reality exists. And by what we believe, we can maybe come closer to that truth than what others can. I mean, it makes no sense to say, well, my belief that Charles de Gaulle was the first president of the United States is just as good as your belief that George Washington was. Okay? Or my belief that the Holocaust never happened is just as good as your belief that the Holocaust did happen. No. That doesn't work. That doesn't work. There is a reality out there. And the quest for truth, the quest for a better understanding of that reality, and the question is, which asks the questions, how did the reality get there? Why is it here? What is our place in it as humans? This seems to me all but a sacred quest, does it not? I mean, just to sit there and think, well, we're here, that's the way it is, we can never really know. Sure, we maybe in this world, we can never know anything absolute. But to sit there and just reject the whole concept altogether seems a bit silly. No, again, I might not know totally what's all about this table, but the table's there. I might see the universe filtered through the limitations of my senses, but there is a universe out there. There is a reality out there. And somewhere out there, there's an explanation for that reality. Now, you can take the position, well, we could never know it, and it's always going to be limited, and we can never have any idea, and your view is just as good as mine, and on and on and on. I mean, if you were on a plane, I mean, I've said this before, you want to fly on a jet built by the, with the voodoo understanding of aerodynamics, or a American, somebody in American Technical Institution, his view of the understanding of aerodynamics. See, not every view is as good as the other. Sure, again, it's filtered. It's filtered. But the fact that something is even filtered should tell us that there's a reality there. How could it even be, if there was nothing there, how could it even be filtered? So the big question for us, and again, it's the battle that goes back to the Earth Giants or the Sophists. You know, and I don't necessarily think that each one was totally right or totally wrong. It happens to be the case where they both have truth. I think the Sophists are right in the sense that reality does come filtered through us and remains in our thinking contingent and fluctuating. I don't think we could deny that. But where I think they're wrong is to deny any real absolute reality at all. And here's where I think Plato and the gods have it right. There is a reality out there. There is an absolute truth out there that we can, to some degree, know. I doubt very much Plato would say everything we know about the world is absolute. But the point is, folks, we can leave ourselves and just say, well, we don't know, and just go on, or we can't know, or we can see something out there and maybe determine in our hearts we'd like to know what that is, and maybe we can know. Anyway, a few things to think about as you delve into this yourself.